Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and in this episode, which we are recording live, we are going to discuss about the outcomes of COP27, which closed on Sunday 20 November 2022 in Sharm el-Sheikh. And I have the honor to connect from London for this conversation with John Martin, who is the UK government's envoy to COP26. And Dr. Martin, John, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
And from Kuala Lumpur, I'm happy to connect with Johanna Niemann, head of Inclusive Green Finance at the Alliance for Financial Inclusion. Hi, Johanna. How are you?
All good. Good evening from Kuala Lumpur.
And here in the Bruegel's house, joining me, our senior fellow expert on climate and energy, Simone Tagliapietra. Hi, Simone. Welcome back to The Sound. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics.
Hello from Bruegel.
I would like to remind our listeners that are connected live for this recording session that this is an interactive conversation and that they can participate to our discussion by asking questions on Slido, sly.do, with the code COP27. You can then access the room and there you can type your question, and we are going to, in the second part of this recording, we are going to get through your inputs from the audience. Let's get back to the topic of the conversation. So, procedurally, no big decisions were due to land at COP27, but the convergence of multiple crises in 2022, such as the Russia war, global inflation, the COVID's long tail, and of course climate disasters, raised the stakes of every increment. The biggest breakthrough came on support for climate victims. Developing countries got the loss and damage fund they fought for, or on the proviso that the burden of paying it does not all fall on rich governments. So who pays and who benefits will be a battle for COP28. There was little to stop polluters causing more damage, though, and a proposal to phase out all fossil fuel, not just the coal power targeted at last year's summit, went nowhere. So, John, I would like to turn to you. You have been one of the key actors of the previous COP, and I would like to ask you, what is your take on the overall COP27 results?
Thanks, Sebi, and good morning to everyone who's listening, or good afternoon, depending on where you are. So back at COP26, we were able to agree with all the participant countries the historic Glasgow Pact that really set out our plans to cut emissions over the coming decade and keep the goal of 1.5 degrees C of climate change alive, the goal of limiting climate change to 1.5 degrees C. And so at COP27, our focus was building on the Glasgow Climate Pact and taking that forward to go beyond what everyone committed to last year. And in that context, we do welcome the landmark progress that was made on loss and damage at COP27 and the agreement at Sharm el-Sheikh to establish a fund to support those who are most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. And it's clear that this deal responded to concerted calls from the poorest and most vulnerable countries. At Sharm el-Sheikh, we also saw progress on a number of key work programmes that were launched in Glasgow, including the Mitigation Work Programme and the Glasgow Sharm el-Sheikh Work Programme on the Global Goal on Adaptation, or what we more commonly refer to as GLAS. Equally, the latest IPCC science is unequivocal. We can't delay action on mitigation. We really need to take action to reduce our emissions now if we're to keep the goal of limiting the rising global temperatures to 1.5 degrees centigrade in reach. And in that context, it's disappointing that there weren't further steps in that regard, including the fact that there was no clear follow through on the phase down of coal, or a clear commitment to peaking global emissions by 2025, or a pledge to reduce the use of all fossil fuels, despite the UK having joined a number of other countries, including the EU, in pushing for this to be included in the final outcome. So we will continue to urgently progress mitigation. We need to continue to urgently progress mitigation commitments. We need to build on what was agreed at Glasgow, because at the end of COP26, we said the pulse of 1.5 degrees centigrade was weak. And unfortunately, after Sharm el-Sheikh, it still remains on life support. So we're going to be working with partners through 2023 to ensure that momentum on 1.5 degrees centigrade isn't lost, and that COP28 can deliver a stronger outcome. And I think I'd end by just turning to what our COP president, Alok Sharma, said in the closing plenary, that you know, the agreement that was reached was not a moment of unqualified celebration. Many of us came to Sharm el-Sheikh to safeguard the outcomes that we secured in Glasgow and go further still. So that's our goal in the time to come. Thank you.
Thank you for this. And I turn to Simone to see his first reactions from what we heard from John, but also going a little bit farther about your take.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Thank you, everyone. I think this was, as expected, a very difficult COP, because it came indeed in the midst of a global energy crisis, I would say, of unprecedented size. And of course, the contradictions between the short-term need, namely in Europe, to substitute Russian gas also by recurring in part to a higher utilization of coal, for example, could have, let's say, led to an apparent contradiction vis-a-vis the longer-term decarbonization objectives. I think Europe managed to explain that while in the short run we found ourselves in the middle of an energy storm and we had to secure supplies to our citizens and therefore use all the possible options to do that, it is in the interest and in the strategies of governments to actually use this as a moment to accelerate the green transition, because that's the only way to decouple Europe from fossil fuels in a structural manner. So I think that overall, this was going to be a difficult conversation, and this indeed was certainly the case. I have to say that while I am reassured by the steps taken on loss and damage, I still struggle to see a significant step further in climate finance. So on loss and damage, I think we achieve an historical milestone. I think we now have a clear commitment to set up this loss and damage fund, which we know was never possible to have as a commitment in the previous years. This is an extremely important step further, but of course we need to see how over the next months these will be designed, who will contribute, and how the resources will be distributed, etc. So I think the most difficult part of this still has to come. When it comes to the climate finance, I struggle to see an important step further in terms of increasing the commitments by developing nations. And I think this is something we need to continue to work on in the coming year, because loss and damage and climate finance, in my view, are together at the center of this international global climate justice dimension, which is basically the reflection of the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. And until we don't manage to fix this issue properly, we cannot expect the climate action momentum to spread across the globe. So I will stop here for now and give it back to you, Giuseppe.
Thank you, Simone. And you've been starting to touch the problem or the issue of climate finance. And of course, I look at Joanna, because the Alliance for Financial Inclusion has been present at COP27, debating about how central banks promotes financial inclusion for climate resilience and mitigation. And I would like to ask you, how do you see the results of this COP having an impact on the work you're doing with central banks on promoting green finance?
Thank you very much, Giuseppe, and really great to join you on the podcast today. From the perspective of the Alliance for Financial Inclusion and the work we're doing on inclusive green finance, there's two different take-homes from this specific COP. The first one is really the strong emphasis on adaptation and resilience building. Of course, we've been discussing it for decades now, but this time there was a very strong emphasis on this area, and there's also enhanced efforts on adaptation. So this is really something welcome and linking very much to the work we're doing. The second is indeed the focus on climate finance, as well as the loss and damage fund. This is something that many of the member countries in the Alliance for Financial Inclusion have been calling for, and it's really great to see progress in this area. Linking to that, not only at the COP, but generally ongoing right now, is really the increased emphasis on greening financial flows and the roles of central banks and financial regulators in this process. So these three elements taken together is really bringing us to the essence of inclusive green finance and the work we're doing with 85 regulators and central banks from developing and emerging economies. And at the essence of that is really how access to financial products and services can enhance climate resilience, but also enable climate mitigation efforts amongst individuals and households. So how having access to insurance, access to credit, access to payment systems, access to formal savings can help people to cope with the impacts of climate change, but also change their own behaviors and consumption, their own businesses in a way that there's less contribution to climate change. So these take-homes from COP are really important for us, and we will continue developing policies with central banks in this area. And also linking to the broader climate finance conversation, we're talking about financial flows, but without access to financial products and services, it's very complicated to ensure that those that need the financing and the resources the most have access to them.
Thank you, Joanna. And I would like to ask John about his reflections on that side of the story about climate finance. But before that, I just would like to remind our listeners who might have just connected right now that in this conversation we are gathering questions from the audience for this podcast live, and you can ask questions on Slido, sly.do, with the code COP27. John.
Thank you. Well, it's really important, as Johanna said, that actually, you know, the finance is made available to support the transition to low carbon economies. And outside of the formal negotiations at COP27, there were some really interesting and notable developments. One of the things I'd draw your attention to is the JETPs, the Just Energy Transition Partnerships. So at COP27, we saw the launch by President Ramaphosa of South Africa of an investment plan that builds on the Just Energy Transition Partnership declaration that was made with South Africa at COP26, where we mobilized $8.5 billion of government finance to support the transition of South Africa to a low carbon economy. And what was launched at COP27 was this much larger investment plan, around $97 billion, that South Africa now wants to crowd in and source from the private sector to support that transition process in South Africa, to help South Africa achieve the most ambitious end of its NDC and reduce emissions to around 350 million tons of CO2 equivalent by 2030. So that was a really valuable step. And we saw the JETP process take another step forward in Indonesia, where there was the announcement in Bali at the G20, in sort of at the same time as COP27, but in Bali itself, where the Indonesians were hosting the G20, of a $20 billion Just Energy Transition Partnership in Indonesia, one of the fastest growing economies in Southeast Asia, where emissions are growing fast. And that's a really substantive package that will work to build a process similar to the one in South Africa to reduce the emissions intensity of the Indonesian economy, to peak energy emissions and to bring them down swiftly thereafter, to limit the use of coal in Indonesia and to set Indonesia on a path to a low carbon economy that is good for growth and good for jobs, as well as lowering emissions.
Thank you, John. And Simone, you have started your reflection by putting it into the context of the ongoing energy crisis. And perhaps one additional step in this conversation is the role of the EU in the COP27, how you have seen the role of the bloc acting during that, and especially now that the COP27 has finished, what are the consequences for European policymakers?
Well, first of all, if I may follow up to what John just said, I think it is indeed extremely important to recall how last year we have seen this cooperation framework with South Africa. This year we have seen this new initiative with Indonesia. I think these are all extremely important actions because they reflect the fact that while it is extremely important to have a unique global framework like the Paris Agreement to set the order, no, of the direction we need to follow in global decarbonization at the global level, we need bottom-up regional, bilateral, multilateral initiatives to turn those targets, those global targets, into reality by basically fostering investments in green technologies, namely for the brown to green switch we need. And I think these kind of different geometries fit perfectly into the spirit of the Paris Agreement and of that global climate action we have. So I think this is really a much welcome step further, the what has been done this year with Indonesia and the progress with South Africa. Having said that, I think the European Union played an important role in the COP in order to try to foster the debate and try to foster the position on stronger language in the final text with regard to climate change mitigation, which not entirely resulted in a success, of course. And we know very well that also the way the Egyptian presidency handled the process and, you know, presented at the very last minute the final conclusions draft, etc., was certainly not helpful in order to have a proper negotiation, I think, of that text. So I hope next year in Abu Dhabi, we might find more space to really make advancements on the mitigation front and, of course, on the adaptation, because we should never dismiss that these are two things that need to go hand in hand. And I am originally from the region of Venice, and yesterday Venice was saved because of an adaptation project, as the mobile dams called MOSE. Yesterday there was the high tide in Venice, historically high, and the city was completely dry because of these mobile dams that have been activated. So this is just an illustration of the importance of adaptation projects, adaptation measures, which we should undertake all across the world. And these should also be at the core of next year efforts at the COP.
Thank you, Simone. And I would like to turn to some of the questions that we are receiving from our listeners, because they are flowing. And in particular, I will start with this one, which sounds to me very crucial question, because Frederick G. is saying or is asking that it increasingly seems like we aren't going to reach our emission targets, especially with the lobbies actively resisting any meaningful change. What can we do? John.
Thanks. I don't think there's we should always be pessimistic. I think there's a lot that's happening that we can be optimistic about in terms of the transition to a low carbon economy and reducing our emissions. we've evidenced in the UK and other countries that economic growth and emissions increases can be completely decoupled. Between 1990 and 2018, the UK was the fastest growing member of the G7 Club of Industrialized Nations and reduced its emissions by more than any other member of that club. And we're almost 50% of the way towards net zero in the UK from our 1990 baseline. So we can make progress, and we've seen really remarkable reductions in the costs of renewable energy and zero emission vehicles and other forms of low carbon technology over the last decade. And to give you an example, in 2012, the UK held an auction for offshore wind and landed contracts in the region of £93 per megawatt hour. And last year we had an auction for offshore wind contracts again. And this year they were down to £37 a megawatt hour. So they've reduced by nearly 60%, over 60% in the course of a decade. The cost of solar is down 85% in the course of a decade. The cost of battery storage is down 85% over the cost of a decade. And now solar power is the cheapest form of electricity that the world has ever known. And the take-up of solar and the take-up of wind has been much greater than organizations like the IEA predicted even just a few years ago. So there's a lot of reason that we can be optimistic that actually the transition to a low-carbon economy can be made and can be made swiftly. The key, as Johanna and others have identified, is finance. There's still too much finance flowing into fossil fuel investment and not enough into renewable investments. And lowering the cost of capital for renewable energy is one of the most important things that we can do. And again, one of the notable things that came out of COP26 was the launch of the Clean Energy Transition Partnership, where 35 countries signed up to end all international support for fossil fuels. And we've seen a number of countries implementing that this year ahead of the end of 2022 deadline. And that's got the potential to switch $25 billion a year out of fossil fuels and into clean energy investment around the world, further supporting the transition to a low carbon economy. So there's plenty of work to do, as the questioner identified, but actually there are reasons to be optimistic as well.
Thank you, John. There are definitely reasons to be optimistic, but there are also reasons to be pessimistic. And that is what our listeners are trying to point out. I think that there was also another question that goes on the same, direction, asking why don't we says all fossil fuels firms and aggressively decarbonize our economy. So basically, the question here is, are we doing enough, and are we doing enough fast enough in order to save the planet? And I don't know if Johanna would like to add on this or Simone.
Yeah, no, thank you, Giuseppe. I think the very simple answer that's clear to all of us is no. The current emissions gap report that came out by UNEP earlier this year shows that with all the current commitments in place, we would still be heading towards a 2.8 degree warming by the end of this century. And that is if all the commitments are honored that are currently in place. So we're definitely not doing enough and not fast enough. But I do also agree with John that there is space for optimism. It filled me with hope to be in COP during the last weeks, to see all the different actors come together, actors that only 5 years ago would not have been involved in a meeting like this one, actors like central banks, commercial banks, also representatives from various sectors that haven't been involved in the processes earlier, and in a very open and honest way discussing how to move forward together and how to build alliances and the different forms of collaboration in order to move forward to a just transition to a low carbon economy. So we're definitely not doing enough, but I also feel there's hope because we're really mobilizing across all fronts at the moment and trying to set up those goals together.
Thank you, Johanna. Simone, do you want to add something on this?
Yes, I very much agree with the point that the cost of capital is a crucial element in this debate. If we look at the investment structure of, let's say, the brown world vis-a-vis the green world, CapEx, so the capital expenditure in the renewable energy system, are much more important than the operating expenditure, simply because the big investment requirements are upfront. to build the wind park, the solar installations, etc. And then you have very low operating cost, which means that a defining feature in defining the speed of the investments is indeed the cost of capital at the end of the day. And that's exactly the reason why it is extremely important to scale up climate finance, because climate finance can provide a great support to developing nations to reduce this cost of capital by putting in place blended finance tools to accompany private investments from international companies in these countries that really need a quick rollout of renewable energy solutions mainly. Let me say, not only because of climate change mitigation, but also, and I think at Africa here, for the sake of speeding up energy access, which is the top priority in many of these developing nations. And I think here lies a great challenge, but also what possibly is the greatest opportunities of our time when it comes to the global energy transition. We have a developing world that needs a lot of energy, a lot of additional electricity capacity in order to provide electricity to a young and quickly rising population. This can be met also by renewable energy, and I particularly think at those rural areas that will unlikely in the future be served by the grid. What international financing institutions here can do, from the European Investment Bank to national development banks and so on, also through initiatives such as the Global Gateway, is extremely important to allow private investors to jump into these promising markets and make the investments that are necessary for these countries, and in turn also for global climate mitigation efforts. And I think, of course, we should discuss about the elephant in the room, which of course is China. And of course, it is the role of coal in China, because that is the individually the most important item, in my view, when it comes to the global energy transition. There is no way to get to 1.5 or well below 2 degrees if we don't address the issue of coal in China and in India. And here the question is, what can we do more to work with China on the phase down of coal and the ramp up of renewable solutions? I think this is a core question with this, in this debate.
Indeed, Simone, you point out to the crucial question over there, and the elephant in the room of China. Of course, we could dedicate a full episode of this, and we also have close attention to the role of China in the Sound of Economics. However, one big question over there is also related to, again, the geopolitical climate where we operate in, and the way things might not be disentangled by the rest of the items that they are on the political agenda. And sometimes it's going to be more and more hard to see climate diplomacy disconnected from the rest of the diplomacy. We cannot say we can do a deal with China just on climate and forget the rest of the complexity of the relations. But we could have a lot of conversation on that. I don't want to open the Pandora box, because our listeners are asking a lot of questions, and I would like to group them together, because there are several ones, especially I would say John might help us to go through, because they relate to the methodology of COP itself. Like, there are many people in the audience that are asking if the current methodology of COP is the correct one, whether there shouldn't be a revision of it, what kind of governance there should be for the future steps in order to advance this important file. And if I might add, I'm a great reader of science fiction. Kim Staley Robinson, in his Ministry of the Future, he imagined a governance structure coming from the Paris Agreement, which could have some power to coerce actors in order to reach the targets. At the moment, we are far from any kind of international body that can coerce others to limit the emissions and get into the vicious circle that we need to.
Thanks, Matt. Well, the UNFCCC is remarkable in that it's a forum where all of the member states of the UN gather together to discuss climate change, and that's that breadth gives it a huge value and legitimacy. You can hear the voices of small island states like Palau being held and heard with the same amount of legitimacy as major industrial emitters like the UK and Germany and others. And that's a really valuable forum, and it's important not to lose it. It's where the legitimacy of the UNFCCC comes from. And you see that helps drive some of the outcomes that we've seen at COP27, like the establishment of the facility. That has a value all of its own. I think we've heard the UNFCCC Executive Secretary reflect on the way that COP27 was conducted and promise to look into the way that future COPs will be done to make sure that everyone has plenty of time and to see all the documents that are circulated and make sure that there's time to get to grips with the text, and we'll look forward to working with Simon Steele and his team as they conduct that review. But one of the really interesting developments we've seen in recent years at COP meetings has been away from the formal negotiations. We've seen more and more announcements and initiatives being taken forward which have real climate world impact. And I've talked a little bit about the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, I've talked about the Clean Energy Transition Partnership, but we've seen really powerful campaigns on things like limiting the sale of internal combustion engine vehicles, setting cutoff dates for the sale of combustion engine vehicles. We've seen campaigns like the Powering Past Coal Alliance. We've seen things like the methane initiative at the last COP. And there are really powerful initiatives that are being taken increasingly to make sure that what's happening at the COP also reflects and is linked up with what's happening in the real world. Because those changes that I described earlier are hugely important. Back in Copenhagen, negotiators were essentially asking countries to trade away a little bit of their economic growth in order to deliver emissions reductions. And now those technological developments that we've seen in the real world mean that increasingly we are asking countries to take measures that will accelerate their own economic growth whilst at the same time delivering emissions reductions. And that becomes something that of a self-propelling process, and the synergy between what's going on outside of the negotiating rooms and what's happening inside of the negotiating rooms is an increasingly important development in the recent meetings of the COP.
Thank you. I have a flood of questions from the audience, so I'm trying to group things out, and I think we can take a couple of more, and then unfortunately we're going to go towards the end of this episode, but it is extremely lively and refreshing to see that people want to participate in the conversation. Obviously, a lot of critical voices, and I would like to. There is a voting score and the voting mechanism on our Slido. So, one of the most voted question at the moment is from Catherine Sheen, and she is asking, why do we trust or listen to the commitments of banks, firms, oil companies that created this disaster? Why are they even a part of the dialogue?
If I may, because like it or not, they need to be part of the solution. There is no way around that. I mean, I think we need to be very, very, very pragmatic here, and being, of course, too idealistic or ideological doesn't serve the purpose at all, unfortunately. One has to understand that the energy transition is going to be an historical endeavor, slashing the share of fossil fuels we currently have in the energy mix globally. 80% of the energy mix today is fossil fuels, memo. And we need to reverse that to less than 20% in a matter of 3 decades. Okay, that's an historical endeavor. And we need everybody on board. Of course, we can discuss for ages about historical responsibilities of countries first, companies second, by the way, citizens that have enjoyed a certain lifestyle because of this energy, by the way. But we need to acknowledge the fact that, there is no unique category. So, for example, for oil and gas companies, there are oil and gas companies that today are trying to reinvent themselves, trying to jump into renewable energy, trying to develop offshore wind, try to foster green hydrogen. So trying to become part of the solution, not because of course, only environmental reasons or, I think partially might also be that, but also because of the fact that they, of course, see this can be a huge business case. And this can provide them a long life while possibly fossil fuels will not be able to do so.
Could I just jump in?
Sure, absolutely.
We saw that there were fossil fuel companies in attendance at COP27, but they're not parties. The UNFCCC is a party-driven process, and the only parties to the UNFCCC are nation states. And that's really clear. So when a text is adopted, as it is at the end of a COP process, it's adopted by the nation states. So please, I wouldn't want listeners to be confused and think as a result of sort of the previous questions and answers that oil companies or banks or whatever are members of the UNFCCC. They're not, it's a party-driven process. What is really important is to make sure that those all companies are acting in support of the transition to a low carbon economy. And we've seen a lot of banks take some quite bold measures about that, and we want to support them. But I think one of the things that's really clear is if incumbents don't move, they will be cast aside by disruptors. If you go back to 2012, I don't think Tesla had made an automobile in 2012. At the beginning of this year, Tesla was the most valuable automotive company in the world. And Toyota and, Ford and all the other automotive manufacturers are having to look and transition. So incumbents really need to move if they're not to be cast aside by disruptors in the sphere of energy, in the sphere of transportation, and in the sphere of finance and other areas.
Thank you. And we still have time for a final question, which has come up from the audience, but I would have asked it nevertheless, which is the prospect for the future. So looking ahead, now COP27 has finished. How do we go for the COP28? What to expect in the run of the preparations? And how do we get ready for next year? And I would like to hear all of you on that.
I think from our perspective, it's really working on Article 21C of the Paris Agreement, which is about greening the financial flows. And greening the financial flows, of course, that means ensuring that financial flows are not going into wrong purposes, but also ensuring that there's more financial flows for adaptation and resilience building purposes, and that this is equally distributed or properly distributed across countries and also within countries to ensure that there is possibility for also the most vulnerable to cope with climate impacts. So focusing on greening financial flows is extremely important. And here, of course, it's action by the entire ecosystem. So that is the regulators, central banks, the policymakers, but also the private sector, as well as the consumer at the other end. So this is something that from our perspective is what's lying ahead in the coming year.
Thank you. Simone?
Yes, I think we need to focus on pathways rather than only looking at targets 2030, 2050. We need to demonstrate that we can accelerate the energy transition now, these years, this decade is going to be defining. We need to demonstrate in Europe that we will really make use of this crisis to accelerate the rollout of renewables with all the legislative measures we need to undertake for that purpose. We need to provide the foundations for this loss and damage facility, so to be approved next year, which will be a challenging task, of course, but a necessary one. And I do think we need to do more on climate finance.
Thank you. And John, your final word.
Adaptation is going to be a hugely important theme from here on in, as it has been in recent months and years. We know that we already have about 1.3 degrees centigrade of climate change, anthropogenic climate change baked in, and that's going to drive a lot of adaptation requirements. And we've seen that in recent months and through extreme weather events. That's going to have to be a theme. Finance, as Johanna said, is got to be a really important theme, not just delivering on the $100 billion of climate finance that developed countries pledged back in Copenhagen and again at Paris, and we set out our delivery plan for doing that, but also the trillions of dollars that are going to be required to accelerate the transition to a low carbon economy. And in response to that earlier question, you know, it's banks that mobilize those trillions of dollars. And if we don't include them, at least in our wider discussions, we're not going to be able to mobilize those trillions of dollars to put into clean energy, to the low carbon economy that we will require. And then in terms of mitigation, it's clear that we are on a trajectory to a low carbon economy. I think technologically and economically, that's baked in. The question is that transition going to happen quickly enough in order to deliver on our climate goals? And there's obviously a considerable element of doubt, and we need to do all we can to accelerate that transition. That means move the finance, as Johanna had said, but also to remove the barriers to the flow of that finance. There are barriers to investments around the world. There are reforms that need to be undertaken to make investments in renewable energy as bankable, as attractive as investments in fossil fuels. And we need to, as a community, undertake those reforms together. And you know, it was a Saudi oil minister who was clear that the oil end will not end because we run out of oil any more than the Stone Age ended because we ran out of stone. And we've got to make sure that transition that Saudi ministers in years gone by have shown an awareness of and an alertness of, that happens as quickly as possible.
Thank you. And unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this episode. And it is obviously not a conversation that we are stopping with the end of this. We will continue to discuss about that on our podcast, our events, and beyond. So I would like to thank to all of you for joining this live recording session of The Sound of Economics. John, Johanna, Simone. And I would like to remind all our listeners that you can read in open access the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.